This morning we're looking at 1 Kings chapter 21 in the Old Testament. Now I've deliberately passed over 1 Kings 19 as it's a favourite of mine and I've preached on it more than one occasion. And 1 Kings 20 raises lots of questions which are better addressed in a Bible study than a sermon. 1 Kings 21, however, brings us to this disturbing story of Naboth and his cynical removal by a king and queen who wanted his land. So much so that they were willing to make false accusations and engineer his death. And it's at this point that Jezebel begins to earn her reputation as a mean, unscrupulous and utterly unmerciful human being. Jezebel has never been a particularly popular girl's name ever since. The story has echoes of a similar episode in the life of King David. David took a fancy to the wife of one of his army officers. The man in question, Uriah, was away on a military campaign, so David had an enjoyable one-night stand with the wife. Unfortunately for David, she became pregnant, and with her husband away at the war, it was going to be pretty obvious that she'd been unfaithful. David tried hard to cover his tracks by allowing Uriah special home leave, but being a man of honour and feeling his place was with his men, Uriah wouldn't take advantage of the offer. So David cynically sent him back to the front with a letter for his commanding officer, Joab, a letter instructing Joab to expose Uriah to the enemy and have him killed. Once this was done, David took Bathsheba to be his wife. It was a double sin that would haunt him for the rest of his life, and it brought the prophet Nathan to the stage to say what no one else dared to say. Our story starts with Ahab wanting to expand the crown estate. He likes the look of a vineyard next door and offers to buy it from its owner, Naboth. Naboth declines on the grounds that it's his inheritance and his children's inheritance after him. Ahab doesn't argue with him, but he goes home and sulks. Jezebel finds his reaction feeble. For goodness sake, you are the king. You can do what you like. But then she takes matters in hand. She writes to some leading figures in the town and arranges for false accusations to be brought against Naboth. In what must have been a horrible and sickening scene, Naboth is accused of cursing God and the king and then is taken out and stoned to death. When word gets back to Jezebel, she tells her husband to go and take possession of the vineyard. But nothing escapes God's attention, and so his prophet Elijah is waiting for Ahab in the vineyard. He pronounces God's judgment on him, his queen, and his dynasty. Ahab is distraught, covers himself with sackcloth and ashes, and repents. His regret does seem to have been genuine, with the result that God tempers and delays the moment of judgment until after his death. Now, there are aspects of this story which may not immediately be understood by a reader from the 20th century. The ownership of land was understood very differently back then. Part of Moses' law concerned a year of Jubilee, and this was highly significant, although there's not much evidence that the Israelites ever observed it. When Israel entered Canaan under Joshua, the land was divided between the 12 tribes. Within each tribe, families were given their own plot of land, and this was their livelihood. They could keep animals, grow crops, make products, and even sell their products onto others. Some were diligent, some were lazy, some were just downright unlucky. From time to time, families would fall into poverty, and they were forced to sell all or part of their land in order to survive. In this way, some families became richer and some became poorer. If your grandfather had been lazy, then you were the one to feel the consequences. But here's the thing. Every 50 years, land had to be returned to its original owner. That was the law. That way, rich people couldn't become too rich, and poor people could see a light at the end of the tunnel. Now, as I say, it's hard to know if this law was ever properly enforced. And once there were kings, things changed anyway. So Ahab, who already had a substantial estate and lived in luxury, wanted a bit more. He wanted the vineyard of Naboth. Naboth, however, reminded him of Moses' law. This, he said, is my family's inheritance. It's not for sale. Now, I think Ahab knew enough to back off, even though he felt frustrated. But Jezebel, who was not interested in her husband's religion, turned him into a tyrant. When Elijah confronted him with what he'd done, they were not crocodile tears. He knew that he had crossed an important line and showed genuine remorse. That said, by the next chapter, the remorse had worn off and he was once again surrounded by false prophets who pandered to his whims. So let me reflect a little bit on this issue of land. It's an important issue in Israel and Palestine at the moment, and around Gaza there are rocket launches and regular deaths over who the land belongs to. But aside from such volatile situations, the issue of land ownership is a big one. Take the UK. The biggest landowner in the UK is the Forestry Commission, and after that the National Trust and the Ministry of Defence. The Crown Estate runs to 263,000 acres. If you want to visualise that, an acre is about the size of a football pitch. In reality, the Crown Estate is owned by the country, not the monarch. But it makes a profit each year, and 25% of that profit goes into Her Majesty's account. The Queen is a puzzle because in theory she owns vast areas of the world, about one-sixth in total. But her income is reckoned to be the 20-plus million she gets from the Duchy of Lancaster, plus the Crown Estate money. So maybe 100 million a year in total. Prince Charles also has a duchy, the Duchy of Cornwall, about 135,000 acres in size, and that earns him a similar amount to the Queen. He pays an allowance of about 6 million to his two sons, although Harry and Meghan are now pursuing a different route and want to be financially independent. And then there are the other weighty landowners. The inventor, Sir James Dyson, who made his name with a vacuum cleaner, he now owns 33,000 acres. Sheikh Khalifa, the Emir of Abu Dhabi and President of the United Arab Emirates, he has a London property portfolio worth £5.5 billion, the jewel in his crown being the celebrated Berkeley Square and the 95 buildings surrounding it. London's biggest foreign landowners are actually from Qatar, but they may soon be upstaged by the Chinese. You will no doubt have heard the repeated complaints that we're gradually selling off our assets. A Danish businessman has bought up 11 Scottish estates and now owns twice as much land as the Church of England. And that's another story. However, be that as it may, my principal concern is over the huge divide between rich and poor. Some people have and some simply can't have. Young people complain that property ownership is beyond them. And buying leasehold rather than freehold is always a risky investment. Buying to let has become a lifestyle choice for many, and although politicians have been considering disincentives, the privately rented sector is big and private rents are extortionate in some parts of the country. In their 2010 book, The Spirit Level, Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson argue that a more equal society is better for everyone. Those who have slightly more don't have to have high security systems, comprehensive insurance and bodyguards, and those who have slightly less don't feel so hard done by. Criminality is lower, mental health levels are higher. People are generally happier. It's not an idea we are brought into in the UK, but it is an idea that Moses was given as he received the covenant teaching on Mount Sinai. Around the time of the English Civil War, nearly 400 years ago, there were two campaigning groups known as the Levellers and the Diggers. They were unsuccessful in forcing reform, but at least they had a crack. In more recent times, there has been a push for a land value tax, so that those with the highest earning plots of land should be taxed more heavily. In that way, the common purse can be enlarged. So this chapter is not just about murder and theft, it's about ideology. And Elijah represented the view that we are all of equal worth, that the interests of those with less should be protected, and that the playing field should be levelled from time to time. Now, I'm not a great political animal. Sandra and I had a discussion about this the other week, and she said I'm less about left and right and more about right and wrong. I tend to agree with her. But I'm also conscious that Isaiah 65 talks about a new heaven, a new earth, a perfect world where every individual gets to enjoy the fruit of their own vineyards and every individual gets to live in their own property. That's why the prophets pled the case of the poor and reprimanded the rich. That's why Jesus began his ministry quoting Isaiah, promising sight to the blind, liberty to the captives, and the acceptable year of the Lord, almost certainly a reference to the year of Jubilee. Back in the 1980s, the then Bishop of Liverpool, David Shepherd, wrote a book entitled Bias to the Poor. He argued that the Christian church should invest more of its time meeting the needs of the poor rather than currying the favour of the rich. That's not to say that rich people don't need Christ. Of course they do. And if we are lucky, their generosity may boost the Sunday offering or benefit some charity. But we have to give attention to those who are the victims of an unjust world, those people who have been denied the basics. Marva spent her birthday doing the food bank last week. Good for her. Others volunteer their time in other ways to help people off the floor and onto their feet. Such people may not enjoy all the things we can enjoy, but they matter every bit to God as we do. So may the great Jubilee vision shape the choices you make in your life. May you discover the joy of generosity and the truth of Luke 6 verse 38. May you not flinch from exposing greed and corruption, for the ground in the age to come will be level, just as it is at the foot of the cross, on that day when Jesus returns to make all things new. Graham Kendrick's hymn expresses it so well. Shelter for fragile lives, cures for their ills, work for the craftsmen, trade for their skills, land for the dispossessed, rights for the weak, voices to plead the cause of those who can't speak. God of the poor, friend of the weak, give us compassion, we pray. Melt our cold hearts, let tears fall like rain. Come, change our love from a spark to a flame.